Good morning, and welcome to the special edition call on the recent market volatility. We are providing this call for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. If you have questions, you can email them to david.lundgren@hancockbank.com. I'll take them at the end of the call. On today's call, we have John Portwood, Chief Investment Officer, and Investment Directors David Lundgren, Jeffrey Tangus, Greg Hodlewski, and Luther McDougall. And with that, I'll pass it on to Dave, who's going to serve as a moderator.
Great. Thank you, Ashley, and good morning, everyone. Welcome to this morning's call. Before I turn things over to John, just going to give a little bit of background information on where we are in the market. As everyone's probably aware, we've experienced really three difficult days in a row, Thursday, Friday, and then yesterday. All in total, the S&P was down about 9% for those three trading days, with the most damage coming yesterday. Year-to-date, the S&P 500 is down almost 7% when you factor in those three trading days. And, you know, as of right now, we've retraced some of those losses. It looks like the S&P 500 is up about 2.3%, so getting a little bit of a rebound here. Small cap and international stocks produce very similar returns from a year-to-date basis. And from the high on the S&P 500, we're down 11% off of its July 20th high, so just a few weeks ago, month ago roughly. And that 11% off the high is the largest correction that we've seen since 2011, and hence the reason that we're having a call today. As many are aware, the S&P for most of the year has traded in a pretty tight range going into last week. And the VIX, you know, went from one extreme to the other. I think, John, and you can help me with this, I think the last 6 months was some of the lowest volatility we've seen in market history. I think I've read somewhere the last 70 years, perhaps.
Something like 70 years.
Yeah, and then yesterday, and the VIX is a measure of volatility of the S&P 500. And as of yesterday, the VIX had its highest close since October of 2011. So pretty extreme swing, you know, pretty rough few days. And, you know, we know that's unsettling for a lot of people, especially when you think about yesterday when the Dow started down, you know, over 1,000 points at the open, retraced a lot of that. And you know, keep it in perspective, too, from a percentage change, because the Dow is such at a high level, it actually, you know, wasn't even one of the 20 largest declines. But that doesn't make anybody feel better by any means. So we understand there's a lot of concerned people. So, John, maybe to start, kind of, you know, give us some thoughts on what caused this three-day correction here.
You know, I guess the smart aleck response to something like that is more people wanted to sell than buy. You know, sometimes you really can't find a proximate cause, but in this case, the proximate cause was probably China, and not necessarily that. I guess there was one piece of news out there that broke the camel's back in terms of the market. But China has been, as we all know, undergoing a slowdown in their growth rate. They've tried internally to staunch the bleeding and try to restore some growth internally using a number of means. The last one was, a wild attempt to pump up the stock market, and then an equally wild attempt to try to bring it back under control unsuccessfully. And all of that, I think, broke a lot of confidence levels, around the world in a lot of sense, and simply precipitated a lot of selling as people recognize that perhaps, you know, China has sort of lost control of their market and their economy in the sense that they can no longer, you know, pull the levers and twist the dials and get a response that is not only, positive for the Chinese economy, but let's say positive for the world economy as well. And China has been a big piece of the world economy now for a long time. And you know, unfortunately, they find themselves in a position now of having a lot of excess capacity. In fact, there's probably excess capacity in many places around the world, not only China, but, you know, that's been reflected in the consistent decline in commodity prices for the last 4 years, which continues. And this has been described by a lot of people as demand deficiency syndrome, and what the world needs is more demand and probably a lot less debt. And so we're still in a long-term sense, you know, the workout period and the transition period after the to something more normal after the credit bust that we experienced in 2008. So it's a recognition that growth is slowing around the world and that, you know, China's having some problems and so forth and so on. And sometimes, everything can come together at just one moment in time as everyone realizes there might be something wrong and somebody decides to sell. And pretty soon you find everybody trying to squeeze through, the door at the same time. The unfortunate thing about these events is that while they have not been telegraphed, I guess, in the sense that we read about them all the time, those of us in the business for the last 5 years, really, certainly ever since a flash crash sort of like this occurred in 2010, we have seen these instances during the day when an individual stock, a group, an industry, you know, perhaps some particular index has been hit by some electronic glitch or some strange trading event that has sent prices substantially in one way or the other, up or down. And some of these have been so quick that they occur in seconds, certainly less than a minute. And prices can change, you know, enormously during that time. And a lot of these aren't reported. Sometimes they quietly cancel the trades because things did get out of control. And even we don't hear about it till the next day unless we're actively involved at the moment in trading a particular security. So that's been going on for a while. And the unfortunate thing about electronic trading, well, it's good news and bad news. You know, the good news is it makes for very efficient, you know, and smooth operations, and it does, in a sense, I guess, increase liquidity. But, you know, strange things can happen, and when these strange things happen and you don't have humans involved, things can get out of hand fairly quickly. Your stock exchange, for example, used to have people on the floor. You know, back in the day, you know, when I started in the business, you actually had a fairly busy NYSE trading floor. And the people making markets in the individual securities were charged by the New York Stock Exchange with maintaining orderly markets on the downside, particularly. And one of their duties was to buy into a decline to try to maintain an orderly market in the midst of a sharp decline. And, you know, while they weren't always successful in preventing some pretty wild swings, if they didn't do what they were supposed to do, you know, they got in trouble and they lost their privileges on the floor. In 1987, to halt that crash, the Federal Reserve had to lean on banks to continue providing money to the traders and market makers on the floor to arrest that that crash and bring about some order. So, you know, those of us who've been around for a while and remember those days, I guess, have always been somewhat suspicious of electronic trading because, you know, that from time to time things can get out of hand, and it doesn't take a lot of trading to do that. And this may have been, one of those instances, particularly yesterday at the open. And I'll give an example of what happened yesterday. ETFs trade like stocks, and that's supposed to be one of the advantages of owning ETFs over mutual funds. Well, there's good news and bad news as far as that's concerned because, you know, if you buy an ETF or sell an ETF, you're not necessarily guaranteed at any point in time of getting net asset value, although at the end of the trading day, you know, the price is probably pretty close to NAV. But in any case, yesterday in the chaotic opening sequences for the market, some very large ETFs traded at almost impossible prices. And I'll give you an example. according to the reports that I saw, you know, yesterday and early this morning, the Guggenheim equal-weighted ETF that represents the S&P 500 had an opening trade down 43% from the previous day. That was not unusual. There were other ETFs that also had opening market trades that were 20-25% below the previous day's close. And this is on a day when the S&P futures indicate a 7% negative opening for the S&P 500. You know, that's for the cap-weighted S&P 500. So, you know, this type of thing, unfortunately, it represents a pricing breakdown in the ETF markets, and it's, again, I think, a function of what can happen when everything is driven by computers and it takes the humans a little bit of time to catch up with what's happening electronically. And, you know, that probably aggravated the situation quite a bit. Unfortunately, since we've seen a number of these things in the last 4 or 5 years, it's probably something we're going to have to get used to going forward until, you know, ultimately somebody figures out a way, you know, to get a little more control over the electronic trading process. And I'm just mentioning all this, you know, it's not related to fundamentals or anything, but because it does have, you know, a rather severe impact on the market. Something else to think about when we think about these sudden movements. It doesn't take much selling to really create a disturbance like this. And I'll give you an example in terms of how much selling and buying it might take to move the market significantly if nobody else does anything. First of all, theoretically, if any one of us went out and bought 100 shares of Apple stock, and we were the first trade of the day, let's say nobody else was trading, and we changed the price of Apple by an eighth of a point or a half a point by either buying or selling, we have adjusted the value of the entire company's stock, and we have adjusted the wealth of everyone who owns the stock. So it gives you an idea of how everything is traded at the margin. But in 1987, during the worst days of that particular, financial accident and crash, less than 5% of the total capitalization of the market was turned over. So the implication here is that 5% of the people wanted to sell. The other 95% stood pat and didn't do anything, and that's probably what happened yesterday. I don't know what the numbers are, but my guess is that 95% of the people who own stock from an investment standpoint were happy to own what they owned and did absolutely nothing. And it was the trading and the algorithms and the high-frequency traders that were out there, you know, creating most of that disturbance in the market. So,
hey, John, I'd like to try and get back to some of the fundamental issues. Before we do that, just a quick question. Now, you talked about how they had traders on the floor that worked, you know, when you had these periods of abnormal trading. There were people on the floor that kind of, you know, acted to support the market. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think a lot of the exchanges have put curbs in place to try and replicate what those traders on the floor did or their function, you know, in times past. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, there are. Obviously, there are curbs in place. They don't work the same way as the old specialist system did.
Yeah.
Specialists were actually buying.
Right.
Instead of just curbing trades.
And then back to the fundamentals, China this morning, I guess, took some action. And, you know, you mentioned that it's always difficult to kind of, you know, say exactly what the cause was. It's not always a direct relationship. But I have to, you know, when you see the action today, you know, and, you know, throw on top of that China reduced their lending rate and their reserve requirement, you know, and then we see this bounce in the market. Does that kind of, you know, lend support to the fact that maybe this is at least a large part of what we're seeing now related to China?
Oh, I think that's true. We saw this sort of thing once before in the case of Japan many years ago. Some of you probably know that the Japanese market went through a period during the 80s where like China, they were forecast to take over the world and manufacture everything for the world. And they had a system then called Keiretsu, which was a tight correlation concerted action between the central bank, corporations, and the government to do certain things. You know, in a sense, it was their centrally planned version of what is happening in China today. Well, that came to an end in 1989 in a massive residential, real estate bubble, and a bubble in the stock market, and the rest is history, I guess. It's taken a long time for that situation to play out. And as Japan moved in those days up or down, it often caused similar movements around the world. You know, if a decline started in Japan, overnight, you would find our market going down the next day, and so forth and so on. There was kind of a circular pattern operating there, and to a degree you see that now. You know, China, I guess, has taken the place of Japan as the, greatest supplier of manufactured goods and so forth around the world, and what happens in the Chinese market is going to have some kind of a ripple effect on ours. So the fact that they cut interest rates on reserve requirements and indicates that they're trying something else to try to hold their economy up, and that should have an impact on their markets. Now, Chinese market was down 7% before they did this, but the reaction of markets to this, to what happened, is probably going to continue for a while. Unfortunately, in the Chinese economy, the central planning aspect there is probably more centralized than it ever was in Japan. And, when the Chinese decide they want to lend money or something, they basically just give orders for somebody to lend something. So I'm not sure exactly if you can read into this that it's a situation like, ours in terms of extending reserve requirements and so forth. They're probably telling the banks to lend more money and we'll back you, and we've got to do something to keep the economy alive. But, but certainly that's probably had an impact on our markets.
And John, in our group discussions, we've talked about, we've really gone through a pretty amazing run for stocks here, going back really to the March 09 lows. We had that one little hiccup in 2011, and then another correction here, obviously, in the last few days here in 2015. And one thing that we've talked about, and I'm going to ask you maybe just to elaborate a little bit on, or maybe Greg chime in, is that, earnings have gone through a tremendous period of growth, which has been healthy, but prices have grown at a little bit faster rate, which, as we've discussed on this call, valuations have, got stretched a little bit. From a valuation perspective, while nobody likes this, it's painful. We wish it would just keep going up. There is something healthy about it. Maybe talk a little bit about the need for these pauses or corrections to occur.
There is a disconnect. There has been a growing disconnect between what's happening at the level of the economy and what's happening to asset prices. And to a degree, there have been adjustments around the world, probably a little greater than what we've seen so far, as far as bringing prices more in line with fundamentals, I suppose. But in the U.S. situation, as you said, profits have been good, and the level of profitability of companies for a number of years was considerably greater than what you would anticipate given GDP growth. Profit margins, for example, have been far above the mean for quite some time. Profit margins now are beginning to sag and move back towards something that is probably more normal. GDP growth remains about what it was, and you're seeing a slowdown in earnings growth. And as that happens, then prices, of common stocks, generally speaking, will begin to adjust come back to a more reasonable level, which obviously is healthy if it happens more often than not, because it keeps the market from or at least helps prevent the market from experiencing these, you know, substantial periods of volatility that get everybody disturbed. You know, you'd much rather that things adjust as you go, so to speak, rather than wait every 3 or 4 years after a boom and then see a bust and then another boom and a bust and all that kind of thing. So it is better to see, you know, more adjustments in the short run than having things get so stretched that when the adjustment comes, it's a big one and it really bothers everybody. So so hopefully, you know, what we're seeing now is an adjustment period to bring us back towards something that is more realistic in terms of, you know, the GDP growth and the earnings growth that's going on. And it will, you know, present some, you know, some better opportunities as, you know, for stock investments as it occurs.
Yeah, unfortunately, I just might add that, you know, these corrections have been so short-lived and then the market runs right back up that we don't really get that valuation adjustment, which, again, is kind of healthy for the market. It wrings out the excesses. But these sharp snaps back to the upside don't really accomplish a revaluation of stocks. So, you know, that is one concern that I have.
Yeah, that's true. That it's probably worth mentioning that I think everybody knows that we have been pursuing a more defensive posture for portfolios for some time because the you know, relative value analysis has not been particularly attractive, and just because we have seen this disconnect that we've talked about, and you know, the move we've had recently, you know, was not really enough to produce valuation levels that were, let's say, significantly attractive to make a, you know, a change in asset allocation.
Jeff, and I'm not sure, and maybe you should touch on this as well. You know, there's been a lot of discussion around just the Fed, and you know, everybody's concerned, are they going to raise rates, are they not? It's been going on forever on when they're going to make the first move. I don't know if that's – I would suspect that that indecision or lack of clarity, maybe is a better way to put it, has also kind of weighed on the market. And, you know, I think we've all learned in you know, business school way back when, you know, that the Fed has a dual mandate. It's, you know, employment and inflation. I don't know how much stock market movements play into the equation, but, you know, does this recent activity, not only with our markets, but what's going on in the world, maybe say, you know, September's off the table now, or is it less likely? Give me a little, how does this affect the Fed and what's happening here in the U.S.?
Well, you know, I guess for listeners who have been on our call prior to today, they've heard us say that we were skeptical about a September rate increase, really for a lot of reasons, primarily because inflation expectations have been continuing to go down. That's one of the Fed's mandates. And so the Fed is looking at inflation and with lower commodity prices, seeing inflation is nowhere to be seen. So there wasn't really any reason for the Fed to increase there. And now with the weight of this market instability, the Fed, in my opinion, is not going to raise in September. If things turned around very quickly in China, maybe that's a possibility, but I would say that's it's extremely unlikely that the Fed raises. As a matter of fact, if you look at some of the market measures, right now, general expectations are only about 50-50 that the Fed even raises before the end of the year. Most people now, and I'm in that camp, have pushed their expectations out for a Fed rate increase well into March of 2016. So while it is basically a coin flip before the end of the year, I think it's in my opinion more likely to happen in March of next year. The reason is that a Fed rate increase is destabilizing to the equity markets over the very short run. And while we can look back at history and see that it really doesn't have a lot of impact on the equity markets over the longer run, and on the contrary, normally when the Fed is raising interest rates, it's because the economy is good and corporate profits are good, so it sort of goes along with the rising stock market over the longer run. But in the short run, it is uncertainty. It is somewhat unsettling. And the Fed, I'm sure, is looking at what's going on in the markets over the past couple of days and saying we don't need any more instability or uncertainty in the market right now. So I suspect they're going to tone it down somewhat and let the market settle, and certainly let things in China settle out a little bit before they start talking more adamantly about a rate increase.
Okay, thanks. And I'll throw this right back to you, Luther. I'm not sure which one of you want to tackle it first, but it appears the bond market, as you would hope, has held up pretty well. Talk a little bit about how the bond market's been affected, and then maybe talk a little bit about the different sectors within bonds.
This is Luther. I'll start. I mean, since over the last couple of days, maybe even a week, we've seen U.S. Treasury yield curve drop by about, not quite a quarter of a percent, about 20 basis points. And we've seen a rally in Treasuries. We've also seen a rally in the municipal market. Municipal spreads have dropped only about five or six basis points, so municipals remain extremely attractive versus Treasuries. We did see a little bit of a sell-off in the corporate market and the high-yield market. The corporate market, as kind of you would expect because they're corporate bonds. The high-yield market is a very high correlation to the S&P 500, something over 60-65%. So you would expect some type of a sell-off there. But it actually held up fairly well. I think high-yield bonds did a little bit better. They had been under some pressure, and they held up fairly well over the past 3 days, at least compared to equities. Not as well as treasuries or municipals, but better than your traditional corporate. So it's kind of been the risk-on, risk-off, where treasuries perform the best, probably followed by agencies, and then municipals, and then corporate bonds, and then high yield.
Yeah, this is Jeff here. What I would add would be that longer-term treasury yields especially are dominated by what inflation expectations are. And with inflation expectations the lowest that they've been really since about 2009, it's hard to see treasury yields rising dramatically in the face of lower inflation expectations. So we've seen that reflected in treasury yields here recently, and I think that's a factor that's going to be part of the treasury yield curve for some time, certainly as long as the price of oil stays down.
Thanks, Jeff. Last question, and I'll ask everybody to kind of comment if they could. Whenever we see this type of market event, it's interesting because you have some investors who, right away see it as a buying opportunity. The market's down, so I must, move into the market now. And then you have, some investors who, I guess, get a little bit panicked and want to sell everything. When really I would suggest that, you just kind of stay the course with what your investment plan is. Any comments or thoughts along, that natural human reaction when you see this type of event to there's this want or need that you have to take some kind of action? John, you want to lead off?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and you pretty much said what the problem is. The problem is that, as human beings from a behavioral standpoint, large moves in the financial markets seem to, produce, responses that would not normally occur in some areas of business endeavor. And unfortunately, we're all prone to overreact or have a tendency to overreact to major moves, one way or the other. But but certainly people, I think, tend to forget, you know, what their long-term goals are and their particular, you know, risk tolerances and, you know, the circumstances surrounding the decisions they made on the front end to establish a particular, you know, asset allocation or asset allocation range that they were comfortable with. And it's just something that everybody has to fight against and always go back and say, why am I in this asset mix? You know, what are the returns, you know, potential for my asset mix going forward over a long period of time, whatever my, you know, goal horizon, you know, happens to be and so forth and so on, and try to resist the pull of the markets, I guess, and do something that is totally, you know, out of character as far as your goals and objectives are concerned. It's something that's tough to do. I mean, it affects even those of us who are in the business and have been for a long time. It's just a natural human response, but you have to think about it carefully and understand, you know, what your goals are and act accordingly.
Yeah, the last thing you want to do is let your emotions get caught up in the market movements and then, you know, radically change your investment objectives. And I think that's probably one of the most important messages I usually tell clients is, you know, let us worry about it. And as long as you've got a well-diversified portfolio, you know, you can ride these movements out. And the key point is, if you do have a shorter time horizon, then, you know, you probably don't want to have a riskier profile and have as much in stocks. And that's something that, you know, can be a topic of discussion with your relationship manager and your portfolio manager.
All right. Any other comments? Thank you, everyone, for joining, and we will talk to you soon.